Welcome to the Solari Food Theories audiocast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. The state motto for Maine is "Dirigo," which meaning I lead. In the area of food rights, Maine has been doing that for the rest of the nation. On November 22nd, 2021, its people voted to enshrine a right to food amendment in the state constitution by powerful national opposition. Maine is the first state to protect freedom of food choice in its constitution. With the conventional food system's lack of quality, transparency, and reliability, and the determination of our ruling establishment to substitute synthetic food for real food in our diets, now is the time to establish a basic fundamental right in written law. Joining us on the audio cast today is Heather Redford, the co-author of the amendment and the face of the Maine food sovereignty movement. Heather and her husband, Phil, own and operate Quills End Farm, a diversified farm in Penobscot, providing nutrient-dense meat and dairy products to their grateful patrons. In this audio cast, we're going to talk about the reasons for the amendment, why it passed, the opposition to the amendment, and next steps for building on the success of November 2nd in Maine and elsewhere. We're going to talk about what you can do to get a similar resolution before the legislature in your state. Heather, it's great to have you back on the Food Series.
So good to be with you, Pete. Thank you.
Well, outstanding work, and it would be an honor for you to recite the words of the Right to Food Amendment to the listeners.
I'm so happy to do that, Pete. So it's Article 25 now that is enshrined in our state's Declaration of Rights in the Maine Constitution. And it reads, "Right to food. All individuals have a natural, inherent, and unalienable right to food, including the right to save and exchange seeds, and the right to grow, raise, harvest, produce, and consume the food of their own choosing for their own nourishment, sustenance, bodily health, and well-being. As long as an individual does not commit trespassing, theft, poaching, or other abuses of private property rights, public lands, or natural resources in the harvesting, production, or acquisition of food."
Okay, this was a lot of toil. Over 6 years, I believe you started in 2015. And I guess people will say, well, we really have this right anyway, even though it's not in any other state constitution. So what were your reasons for originally introducing the amendment?
Well, as you know, we've had a history before we engaged with even thinking about a constitutional right. It wasn't the first action that we kind of chose out of the deck of cards, but we've been engaged, and we meaning our farm patrons, local farmers, farm workers, and an increasing number of legislators in the Maine legislature had been really working on the idea of local self-governance of food, so some food sovereignty, and at the local level. And then our farm got engaged in the first place over changes in poultry rules and milk rules, milk laws and policies that were being changed at the state level under federal pressure. And so through that whole process, we became aware that, you know, so many people were saying, why do we even have to go to our state capital to fight for these things? Of course, we have the right to food. We have the right to choose what foods we eat. And so, you know, around 2010, as you know, the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund had taken a case at the federal level in a federal district court. And it happened to be about the interstate exchange of milk. But the FDA came out in writing in that case and said that there is no absolute right to consume or feed children any particular food. There's no deeply rooted historical tradition of unfettered access to foods of all kind. and that when the plaintiffs in the case, people who were farm patrons, asserted a fundamental right to their own bodily and physical health, it was found that that they didn't have that. They had no fundamental right that was recognized to obtain any food they wish. So in 2013, Senator Craig Hickman was a representative at the time, and he and I worked on the Maine Food Sovereignty Act. And we had our first legislative effort had failed. And more of this sort of downward pressure was coming from, you know, the corporate regulatory food structure on into our state policy. And we had a conversation that winter of 2015 where he said, what if we go big? They're saying we don't have these rights. Let's have this conversation at a state level, and let's make sure that what we as peoples, as individuals, assume that we have for rights, let's protect them. Let's give ourselves the legal standing that we don't have now. And let's ensure that in the highest form of law that we can. Let's put it in the Constitution. Let's put it in writing. So that was the original impetus back in 2015. And then, of course, as time went on and learning more about Maine's food system, that we import upwards of 90% of the food that we eat in Maine. We're incredibly vulnerable to long supply chains. We have very high levels of food insecurity in Maine. And so along with the pieces about food self-sufficiency and food choice came an understanding that we really needed to protect this as a fundamental human right, also as freedom from scarcity of hunger and to ensure a greater legal protection for food self-sufficiency, growing and raising our own food, harvesting our own food, foraging our own food, bartering and exchanging, and to really work to address food insecurity from this fundamental level.
Yeah, I know it was just kind of a strike against the corporate food system in a way, because I think, you know, and we've talked in the past, I guess, about the history of local food in Maine, and a way was reclaiming traditional foodways through this mm-hmm. amendment or trying to do that, and just trying to strengthen the sense of community.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, if you could speak to that a little more on.
Yeah. Right. We really did see this as an antidote to the corporate control of our food supply. And shifting the levers of power and decision-making back downwards towards people. So with the Maine Food Sovereignty Act, we had ensured a role for communities, for municipalities. So at the community level, that people could ensure a right to food and determine how their food needs are met, their food exchanges take place. But going to the constitutional level meant that we'd be in ensuring that shift of power from the corporate influence on how all of our food policies are made to the individual level, where now individuals have an instrument, peoples have an instrument to inform better policies, but also an instrument for them to use themselves, both as legal standing if there are challenges or infringements on this newly protected right, or as proactive measures of policy to really reclaim a space in our food system for the people who eat food and the people who grow food, and away from the corporate structures.
Right. And I think, you just used the word instrument, but I think you also called it like a metric to influence state food policy. And it's a way legislators can look at the progress made just implement the right policies going forward.
Absolutely, because, you know, just like with other rights, anytime there's a law that's introduced in the legislature, there's the whole process of committee deliberation and consideration includes looking at the Constitution, to see if something is going to be unconstitutional or if it's supporting a right that's in there. So, you know, we've seen that with freedom of speech in recent years, obviously freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, and all of those rights need to be considered when bills are being deliberated to become laws. And so it really is now a metric and a standard to inform and guide those policy priorities and lawmaking for legislators, and then a strong instrument for people to make sure that our lawmakers are informed and understand the rights that we have.
Right. Okay, so I think this was either the fourth or fifth time this had been before the legislature. So what was different in 2021? What were the factors leading to the amendment passing in the legislature this time around?
Well, as with so many things, we can't talk about it without mentioning the influence of the pandemic. People in Maine, there's just a rising awareness. The last time this was considered, it was on the floor of the House in March of 2020 when our legislature shut down. And then when it was reintroduced the following legislative session in 2021, people had seen a lot of what's behind the curtains of our food system. They'd seen the vulnerability in our food supply chain. There was an increasing desire and a need for greater food self-sufficiency, resilience, and then to protect this as a fundamental human right. People are definitely thinking much more in a rights-based framework right now. And then our levels of food insecurity went through the roof. Politically, the landscape also changed where the legislative lead sponsor had always been Craig Hickman, a Democrat, and he termed out and wasn't in the legislature at the time of this bill's introduction. But a Republican named Billy Bob Falkingham from a different part of Maine, from down East Maine, who is a fisherman, was so passionate about taking this bill forward and told Senator Hickman when he termed out that he would absolutely take this forward. So we had a different political landscape too, where the Republicans had a strong voice in their caucus that was really advocating for this and helping them understand it in a way that they really couldn't see so long as it was being sponsored by Senator Hickman. So that really, really helped in the House to bring a lot more Republican votes. And the Democratic leadership was behind it this time as well. And then in the process of the committee hearing, Senator Hickman was elected to the Senate in a special election. And so then we had a strong champion in both the Maine Senate and the Maine House. And so that I think was the sort of the landscape. And the opposition, the lobbies that were opposing this in the state house really sort of overshot and got very, very outlandish in their arguments against the amendment in a way that I think in the end actually helped us, because they just got so far-fetched that it became more difficult for people to oppose it.
Was this the Grocers Manufacturers Association? Who were the opponents when the resolution was before the state legislature?
So the strongest opponent at that time was the Farm Bureau. And they, like I say, their arguments became very outlandish. They started saying that this was going to enshrine a right in our constitution to steal, and that people were going to have the right to steal food, and they could steal up to $5,000 of food. I mean, it was just really bizarre. The other opponents that came up in the very last session here were the Humane Society of the United States showed up for the first time the last couple months of deliberation, and the Veterinarian Association in Maine that had also never been part of the process previously. And they started raising the specter, really, of an argument about animal welfare. And in the legislature, it just didn't get any traction. At that point, the legislators knew more about the issue and recognized that those arguments really were not relevant to the language in the constitutional amendment. But those were the primary opponents when it was in the legislature.
Right. So, I mean, it passed. I think that you have to get a two-thirds majority in Maine and in both the Senate and the House, right? And it passed pretty comfortably. Didn't you get over 70% in both?
Right. I think there were only 30 legislators in the House that voted against it in the end. If you look at the entire composition of the legislature, we were close to 75%. You know, we needed 66.6 or 67% to have two-thirds. Right. And in the end, it really sailed right over those marks. By July, the Senate had passed it with more than two-thirds vote on July 6th. And so then we knew we were headed for the ballot box.
Oh. Yeah, it was interesting because I understand from someone who's working on the measure that a few months before the election or just the referendum on it, I understand it was polling like 70%. And all of a sudden, it seemed like this national opposition came in. Could you talk about that and how big a surprise it was, and just what you were able to find out. I mean, where did these people come from?
Right. That was really our question. Where did these people come from? Right. So, like I say, the amendment cleared the Maine legislature on July 6th, and late in that summer of 2021, early fall, we started hearing from organizations like the Sierra Club, like our statewide food bank, Good Shepherd Food Bank, and some other organizations, that there was a group that was making pitches to them of opposition. And frankly, at that point, the argument seemed so silly and flimsy that we didn't give it a lot of credence. And neither did those organizations. But we were starting to see that it was organized. And then as we got on into the fall, we learned that they actually had $50,000 to start throwing at it. We didn't still know who it was, but we could tell that there was an animal welfare coalition behind it. And then as we really got into the campaign in earnest, we saw that this group, Animal Wellness Action, was based in Washington, D.C. And then when you looked at the board of that group, you could see that it had merged with another group called the Fund for Animals, and that a man named Wayne Pacell, who had been part of the Humane Society of the United States, was behind those groups. He'd left in scandal, but one of our best advocates on the ground here did some research into the Humane Society of the United States and to Animal Wellness Action. And as you flipped kind of the bio cards on the board of these organizations, we could see that a group called the McKinsey Company was very heavily represented on the board of the Humane Society of the United States, that had nothing to do with animal shelters, as a lot of people think, or animal rescue. But that ever since that Wayne Pacell had been involved since the early 2000s, it had really shifted its priorities and increasingly focused on opposing hunting, fishing, and animal agriculture. His mission was really clearly stated, that they were going to use the ballot box and the democratic process to stop all hunting in the United States, to go species by species, starting in California and then going state by state. It was, and this McKinsey group was really just, it's a huge consulting group that has some of the largest corporations in the world as its clients, advising governments, military, corporations. And they really are, they have a totally different vision of our food system, which is moving towards entirely lab-grown meats, you know, vertical hydroponic agriculture in urban areas where all of the, you know, our vegetables will be grown indoors using hydroponic technologies, and aquaculture. And so it's an entirely centralized, very human controlled, corporate controlled vision of the food system that they were working towards. And so then here we showed up in Maine as this little like fly in that big ointment, and say, and could effectively put up a safeguard around these more traditional food ways, around animal agriculture, around hunting and fishing, in a way that meant they weren't going to be able to go state by state, because the types of laws that they would like to propose would clearly be unconstitutional and would violate a human right to food. So, you know, as we kind of found out who the wolf in sheep's clothing really was, It was pretty daunting. It really was the Goliath of the food system that had showed up on Maine's doorstep, and of course had, I think the operating lobbying budget of the Humane Society of the United States was $40 million. So they had really big tools they could throw at us. But one encouraging thing, in a way, that we heard early on, when we heard that number of $50,000, was clearly they had a lot more. And as you said, there was already like a clear understanding that the headwinds were with us, and there was a 70% likelihood of our passage. And so that they put, for them, so little monetary resources behind an opposition did sort of indicate that they knew it was likely to win, and they were really trying to chip away at the majority so that it would be close at least. And they could kind of get a foothold for their narrative,
which
they were successful in doing, but not in influencing the vote.
Well, I think it was the same thing you said about the state legislative session. They just had these ridiculous hypotheticals, like just the animal welfare. That was one of the issues they brought up. The amendment would compromise the animal welfare laws, and they talked about people now having the constitutional right to eat dogs and cats. Right. And I had no idea the synthetic food movement was going to, just challenge this like it did. Because if you looked at the connections of some of the people with Humane Society, they had connections to, I think Beyond Meat was one entity. Another one was Impossible Burgers. I mean, the CEO for Impossible Burgers has been quoted as saying he wants to see the end of animal agriculture by 2035. So it was, just a real eye opener. And it was kind of like a testing ground for what might go on elsewhere. I think you were better prepared than a lot of other states might be to take it on. But it's just maybe a vision of the future when this thing comes up again.
Right. And I think that will be helpful to other states considering it. I mean, one of the other groups, it really does sound fantastical, but this was the monolith. Another group is called the Alliance for the Green Revolution that sits on the board, or that is advised by this McKinsey group. And that was started by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And as a lot of people in food and farming sectors know, Bill Gates is now the largest owner of farmland in our country, and is absolutely a supporter of biotech. So it really is this entirely different vision of a food system that's reliant on biotech. And as you're saying, I hadn't heard that term before, but a synthetic food movement that is entirely fabricated by humans. Instead of working with soil and land and water.
I wouldn't call it, I think movement's the right the wrong word. There's not a movement. It's a small number of rich people pushing this. It's mainly, yeah, just the synthetic food industry, which is these people are putting billions of dollars into right now. But yeah, I guess another thing to look at for the future too is, how did this national opposition coordinate with the state opposition from what you saw? Were they working independently, or were they working together? Because there were local chapters of Humane Society, right? And then what about Farm Bureau? Did they work with some of the national groups?
Yeah, a lot of that was hard to see, honestly, even for us. But as allies came on, we could start to see some of those linkages. So one of those allies was the Sportsman Alliance of Maine. And they had already had a lot of experience with this Wayne Pacelle of Animal Wellness Action and the Humane Society of the United States. So the Farm Bureau had reached out to the Sportsman Alliance, as they are, or were up until that point, up until the Right to Food, they were generally allies. And so they invited him to a meeting where Wayne Pacelle was going to be presenting and really speaking to try to get all these organizations to oppose the Right to Food. Well, once their executive director saw Wayne Pacelle's involvement, all the alarm bells went off about what was this actually about. So they did start working with the Farm Bureau, and then also with the veterinarian associations. So in Maine, it looked very much to people like there were just these independent opponents to the Right to Food. And one of them was a veterinarian association, and it looked like an entirely independent process of opposition. But of course, the veterinarian associations were also working hand in hand with Animal Wellness Action and linked in the messaging pretty lockstep. We started hearing them all saying the same things.
The state and national groups had the same message pretty much?
Exactly. And once the Sportsman Alliance of Maine got involved, we saw Wayne Pacelle take a back seat, and we didn't hear from him again, but we did start hearing from representatives of those groups, like Gina Carey, who'd been a vice president of this McKinsey group and of the Animal Wellness Action. And she became sort of the face of the animal welfare argument in Maine, along with the veterinarian associations.
Right. So I think you wound up passing with just over 60% of the vote, which is still a pretty strong majority. So that, really the next step, I guess, is what does the amendment mean? People are looking at it differently. I just heard from someone up there shortly after the after the referendum that the NPR type radio stations were really upset about the result because they thought it would mean people could engage maybe in neighbor to neighbor commerce and would be beyond that. How do you interpret the amendment? Because it seems like, this is trying to get people more self-sufficient to not only grow food, but if they're in a spot, instead of relying on the state, to acquire food somehow. So what's your interpretation of it? It talks about, the amendment talks about growing, raising, harvesting, producing, and consuming the foods of your choice, but it also talks also about the acquisition of food. Mm-hmm. So what is your interpretation of this amendment? Does it give people the constitutional right, if for whatever reason they're not able to grow or raise their own food, how would you interpret the word acquisition?
Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the great questions, and I'm so glad for them, because one disappointing thing that's happened post-election is that we've seen that the opposition narrative has been the one that's been primarily featured in Maine's media, and even some national media like The Economist has really, talked sort of 5-1 to opposition arguments. So what does it mean? is a question that is often asked about the right to food, whether it's in Maine or any place in the world, you know, Ecuador, Nepal, Nigeria is working on this right now as well. So our amendment language has four parts. And I just to answer your last question first, what about acquiring? What about acquisition? Yes, absolutely. It allows people a legal standing that we didn't have before. So if someone who is not able to grow or raise food for themselves to adequately nourish themselves, the amendment requires that policies be supportive of people's right to acquire the food of their choosing for their own health and well-being. So gives legal standing to patrons to consume the food of their choosing. And that's in the third clause. So yes, there's new legal standing for people that didn't exist before. But the four parts of the amendment in terms of the broader meanings and potential implementation is that first clause being all individuals have a natural, inherent, and unalienable right to food. That we're talking about an internationally established definition. That means that food must be adequate, it must be available, accessible, and sustainable. So if a person has to either be able to feed themselves directly from land or other natural resources, or be able to purchase or obtain adequate food. And the government's role there isn't to provide food, but just like with our other protected rights, the government's role is to protect and respect this right. And all of those words, of course, protect and respect, have their own definitions about what that looks like. And one of our primary short-term goal is to write this all down for people in a people's implementation guide to the right to food. So this will be clearly laid out and defined for people. So the second clause of our amendment is that the right to food includes the right to save and exchange seeds. So here we are really working to secure the resilience of Maine's food supply by nurturing and protecting our own genetic seed diversity. And so that is now protected in perpetuity in the highest form of law. And as anybody knows who's paying attention to the food system, there are four major corporations in the whole world that control the bulk of our seed. So this is another one of those huge shifts towards people owning our own food.
Did you see any evidence that those corporations were lobbying against this directly or indirectly?
You know, Pete, the very last weeks of the campaign, we started seeing these emails from our supporters and more pressure on our, one of our allies was the Maine Organic Farming and Gardening Association. They started hearing a lot more arguments that this was going to allow Monsanto to come in and take over Maine's food supply. So it was another one that, you know, wasn't very well grounded in reality. But this clause is one that specifically, you know, protects seed for people, seeds that aren't already patented, seeds that haven't already been taken out of the people's realm. It leaves us protecting what's left.
Right. And yeah, speaking of giants, how are you, were you able to track how just the economists get involved in it? It just shows this is an international issue too. How did you see that they got interested in this amendment?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when we looked into the types of stories that they cover, it does, they're absolutely in this other worldview of this synthetic food being the way of the future. Their stories are all about aquaculture, about the lab grown meats, you know, impossible meats, beyond meats, about biotech as being the way of the future. So I don't know how they specifically heard about it, except that it was a national story through the Associated Press and all those press wires. We were also, I mean, on the good side, hearing from other organizations outside of our country reflecting back to us what a huge win this actually is, because of the corporate control of America's food supply, other countries that are working on food sovereignty and right to food issues have given up on America because it's already completely captured by corporations. That's what they see looking from the outside in. So the fact that this, you know, small rural state in America was able to bring the right to food to the whole country was just phenomenal. And so we've also seen that kind of international interest that isn't just coming from publications that have a different, different ideology.
Well, I think part of it is just to getting intellectual property rights over food with this synthetic food, just patenting certain foods and licensing people who want to, So right. It's just trying to take a chunk of the food supply under the intellectual property laws as much as possible. But I want to get back to we were talking about the word acquisition. Mm-hmm. So the way I read that amendment, that means if someone, a Maine resident, wants to be able to get food from an unlicensed, unregulated producer, they have that right. That's protected in the Constitution. I mean, so I think they are informed. The Constitution just leaves people, the prerogative to do that kind of thing. And what's your assessment? Would that include unregulated commerce? I know you've got about a quarter of the state that has these food sovereignty ordinances where you can buy from an unregulated producer under the ordinance, but what about the rest of the state? Do you think that would be covered, protected by the Constitution?
So I like that you picked up on the word acquisition. As you know, the more direct form that we had earlier in an earlier version of the amendment did have the word acquire. And we took that out to compromise in the legislative process, but the word acquisition is still there. And even more strongly, I think, for what you're talking about is that that second clause that says that, the first clause, and I'm getting myself all mixed up on this, but it's actually the third. That says we have the right to grow, raise, harvest, produce, and consume the food of our own choosing for our own nourishment, sustenance, bodily health, and well-being. I think the answer is yes, that it gives legal standing that didn't exist before to a patron who would want to, if they felt that that right was being infringed, they would then have a legal claim to make that they didn't have before this amendment passed. So when you go back to 2010 and look at what the plaintiffs were making for a case then, that they had a fundamental right to their own bodily health and well-being, and the federal district court said, no, you don't. In Maine, it's clear that we now do, that is a constitutionally protected right. So there's a legal standing there for people to make that defensive claim, as well as those proactive measures we talked about earlier.
Right. I know, I heard shortly after the resolution that there was a possible, people were thinking about just building up some kind of litigation fund for the challenges to try and dilute the amendment. Have you gotten any inkling of a potential legislation against the amendment yet, or do you think just more time needs to pass to get a better picture of the legal landscape?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an awesome question, because of course that was something that the opposition was really one of the fear-mongering tactics was that there were going to be so many lawsuits coming from municipalities, and people were going to want to have cows in our biggest cities, and that there was just so much litigation in the pipeline. So right now there isn't anything on the horizon. And I think as a sort of an organizing effort, our movement is really, I think, again, to answer your last question first, yes, more time is needed to solidify this and to educate and sort of flip the script that the opposition narrative has been able to root in Maine, and really define our terms, put that into an implementation manual for people, so people understand what those words mean, what the principles are, what their legal standing is, again, and as a metric and a standard to inform policy. So both for individuals, you know, at the level of people, and also lawmakers to inform policy. So lawsuits are, of course, still possible as and if the human right to food becomes infringed. But it's also important, I think, to think of it as a proactive instrument for people to use. And that's where we are right now. And I'd say in the same way that we learned from working at the local level and letting that spread horizontally, people started to understand food sovereignty in a way that, 10 years ago, nobody was talking about in Maine, or I shouldn't say nobody, but the general populace didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And now that's become a much more familiar concept to people before it went vertical to the state level. And I think that that's going to also be true with the right to food in Maine, and maybe is a nice segue to talk about some of the other states that are working on this. But as other states also pass a right to food in their constitutions, it's just going to help solidify all of it moving forward. And that seems to me to be a really positive thing before litigation that would be, precedent setting. So I think that those are important steps to get in place first, getting that implementation manual out there. The intent and the purpose becomes clear and visible to everybody. And then helping other states work toward passage to really strengthen the right to food nationally. And each of those efforts will also strengthen it at the state level for those individual states.
Yeah, before I get more into what's going on elsewhere, what's the agenda in Maine for the current legislative session, and what kind of bills there which could complement or augment this state right to food amendment you now have?
Mm-hmm. So the timing of it is interesting because the constitutional amendment became law right before our short, what is called in Maine, our emergency legislative session. So no legislation could be introduced after the passage of this constitutional amendment, not this session. So the one bill that is there in the pipeline that we kind of think about as in a way that right to food is the principle out of which food sovereignty legislation could grow. In Maine, we did it the other way around, where there is food sovereignty legislation that passed first, ensuring that people have the right at the municipal level to determine their own food system, define its terms, determine the exchange. But when that bill passed in 2017, there were some language inconsistencies in it. It was being reworked at the 11th hour late into the night. And so there are two amendments that we would like to see happen in the Maine Food Sovereignty Act, in a bill proposal called LD74, an act to clarify and increase access to the Maine Food Sovereignty Act. And so what that would do, we have a number of unorganized territories and plantations in the state of Maine that don't have municipal government. So they don't have access to the Maine Food Sovereignty Act.
Those are kind of the equivalent in an area of unincorporated sections of a county, similar.
Exactly. Yeah, they don't have a local government. So without a local government, they can't pass a local ordinance to determine their own food system. So we want to increase the access to the Maine Food Sovereignty Act by including those unorganized territories and plantations, and then clarify those language inconsistencies that got written into the bill originally that are, and in some municipalities, undermining the people's ability to define the terms of their own food ordinances by clarifying that it's up to a municipality to define their terms and enact their ordinances. So that's the other piece to that that we really think could strengthen the decision making from the bottom up, and the ability of people who eat food and to raise food to be at the heart of the decision making about food.
So this would clarify the language on venues. I think some of the opponents of the Food Sovereignty Act were trying to limit transactions to the farm. So this would allow farmers markets, just other sales for other venues. Is that what part of the clarification would be?
Exactly. Right. Some of the municipalities felt that they had to write ordinances that would restrict the food exchanges to happening only on the farm. And that was clearly not the intent of the Maine Food Sovereignty Act, but that people could get together at their own town meetings and decide. And especially with, you know, when you're thinking about in Maine, we're primarily a rural state, and, you know, some of our towns have 300 people or 60 people. And that, you know, the people that are growing food and wanting to exchange it amongst each other in a community may live down really, you know, down dirt roads that are far from any kind of market, and but their neighbors are going to want the food that they're growing, and so it's to facilitate those and during the pandemic, you know, another thing that we've really seen in Maine, and I think a lot of people have seen, is, you know, the necessity of providing more services from the farm, delivering right to people's doorsteps when everybody wasn't going places, you know, especially our elder customers needed home delivery. And so those are the kinds of things that the way the Maine Food Sovereignty Act is worded now leaves ambiguity, that's not allowable by law. And that's not really going to strengthen our food system from the local level up, if it's, you know, limiting the way that people can access food like that.
Right there. Yeah. It's just fantastic. The local food infrastructure you're building in Maine, it seems like there are three pillars now. One is the Food Sovereignty Act. The other is the Right to Food Amendment. Then there's a third one, which is strengthening the food infrastructure in Maine. You talked about it last time you were on. I think you called it the Pitchfork Resilience Project. So if you tell the listeners what that is and, yeah, what progress it's making at the present time.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, in a way, the impetus for getting involved with all this in the first place was that there was a lack of infrastructure, and it was being mandated that small diversified farms rebuild an agricultural infrastructure in the state of Maine that had been allowed to fall into non-existence, and that wouldn't work in a way that is going to create a more resilient food system if all of our resources are going to fund farms that grow commodities for export, right? That's not going to strengthen Maine's food system. So a group of us worked on what we called the Five Tines of Resilience, which was a pitchfork because the pandemic had thrown so much poop at us. We needed to, just like, you know, farmers roll up our sleeves, grab a pitchfork, and turn that that pile of manure into compost. And right. The way to do that was to invest resources in Maine's processing, distribution, and storage infrastructure. Most of our farms are, you know, operating on duct tape and baling twine, and could all produce food more efficiently and produce more community-based food production if there was some investment in infrastructure. And so the current Commissioner of Agriculture, it was a passion of hers as well. Before she was a commissioner, she worked on the New England Food Project, which also heavily emphasized the need for processing, distribution, and storage infrastructure in the state of Maine. And now that the state has earmarked $20 million from the America Recovery ARPA Act that came out of the federal legislature, the federal Congress, Maine earmarked $20 million to go towards food processors and food producers in the state of Maine to add infrastructure. And this will not be surprising to you to hear, but we just heard from the Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry, the application deadline has closed for those grants. Right. And they have, you know, earmarked $20 million, but they got grants exceeding $177 million of requests for infrastructure. So it's the process of this, I think, has just been phenomenal. 850 applicants. It will just make visible what the need is in Maine and how much more food we could be growing and feeding ourselves if there was real investment. So that's an exciting piece to really pay attention to moving forward.
Yeah, I remember when you were talking about it earlier, you said there would be a concentration like slaughterhouses, milk plants, and grain mills, I think.
Right. Yeah. If we could strengthen our dairy, strengthen our grain, strengthen our meat production, and then just get that storage and distribution. We'd also proposed a tax credit to incentivize local food consumption, both at the individual level and at the processing level. And those parts are, you know, part of this grant, but those other pieces certainly can be if people are out there and, you know, looking for ways to diversify from this commodity system into those dairy, grain, and meat for sure.
How much grain production does Maine have?
Oh, I can't answer that, Pete. I don't know. We have there's sort of the microbrewery world that uses barley, and then of course the animal agriculture. You know, we get our barley and oats from Aroostook County, our northernmost county. But I don't know the numbers.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on to other states. I know just other states looking at adopting a right to food amendment or something similar. I know you've been working in West Virginia with folks probably for a couple of years now. What's going on there?
Right. Yeah, we've seen interest since the passage. I'd say probably a dozen states, and I don't think I can tick them all off for you, but certainly Indiana, Montana, Illinois, Wisconsin. And then the ones that we've worked most closely with are West Virginia, as you mentioned, Washington State. And of course, we're hearing good things from Tennessee as well. And more southern states are really seeing the right to food as a way to combat food insecurity and increase our ability to grow and raise our own food and get it from farms that we want. So in West Virginia, they have a very short legislative session, just 2 months long in the winter. And they, this is their second time. They took our unadulterated language before we amended it so heavily through our process. And they've introduced that. And it is their goal this legislative session is to get it out of committee and onto the floor of the House, where their lead sponsor, a delegate, Danielle Walker, is a representative. So that's where they are in the process. But as they go, they are really doing what's so vitally important to any successful effort. And they're really building the opportunities for discussion at local levels. They've passed a local resolution. They don't have home rule there, so it can't be an ordinance, but they passed a local resolution. So again, getting people engaged and thinking about the right to food, and are starting to work at that, you know, sort of micro level. to build awareness and support as it goes through legislative process in successive legislatures. So it's a pretty exciting way that they're moving forward in West Virginia, really just building the people power first and catalyzing that before they're expecting any kind of, you know, home run over the finish line.
Right. So they're, if things work well for them, they're looking at 2 or 3 years out where it would be before the voters.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Washington, I think, is a tougher nut to, well, actually, it'll be interesting to see the national lobbying in West Virginia if this does get more traction, because Northeast West Virginia is kind of like a bedroom community of DC. And I think I mentioned to you on one of our calls that there was a raw milk bill, just thought it was a pretty standard herd share bill to legalize herd shares. And they wound up getting it passed the second year, but the first year the governor vetoed it due to lobbying by the International Dairy Foods Association, the National Milk Producer, the National Milk Producer Lobbying Federation. And yeah, those are about as big as you get for Washington dairy lobbyists. So, but going to Washington, it has, yeah, I think it's used to heavy regulation. I mean, just a lot of things are regulated more heavily in Washington with the small farmers than they are in other states. So what is happening there right now? What kind of progress have people made?
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point. I mean, the DC lobbying groups were the ones that, you know, provided the most funding for the opposition in Maine. And if West Virginia is that much closer, I'm hoping that our process here was really helpful to them in exposing that opposition, because DC is a lot closer to West Virginia.
Yeah.
And like you say, those sort of tentacles of power are just closer at hand. In Washington State, the initiative is being led by a group called Northwest Harvest, which is an independently run food bank organization, very much invested in communities, in addressing food insecurity. And so they've really outlined a different process than, you know, it's sort of percolating from farmers and eaters and individuals, but they're starting at this organizational level, and they've outlined a 5-year process where they will work with people in municipalities. So following a similar model to what we did in Maine, but just in a more orchestrated way, reaching out to funders to start. You know, we had no financial resources going into that campaign, which still makes it even more extraordinary that it got over the finish line like it did. But, you know, again, having learned from what we did here, Washington State is going to try to work to secure funding first, and then those local community organizers that will get involved will have funding for the work that they're doing instead of it being, you know, a work of dedication and commitment. They'll also be funded.
Right.
So there is an exciting effort there to watch too, you know, of just seeing people coalesce and come together and work towards the right to food out there as well.
What kind of organizations have been providing funding to them? Have you gotten any word on that, to if they've been successful fundraising and who has donated?
Do you know, I think they've actually reached out to the Safeway Foundation and some of the, you know, not places that you would expect to work to support a right to food. But, you know, again, they're building that education and awareness first. And that's I have a pretty limited, you know, picture of that. But I know that they've reached out, you know, they reached up first to do that kind of funding.
I do have some news for you on Tennessee. There was a hearing Tuesday, and It did not pass out of committee. The consolation is the resolution can be introduced either next year or the following year, and the timetable is still the same. Even if it passed this year out of the legislature, there wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have been before the voters until November of 2026. So it's the same thing. What has to happen there is it has to pass the legislature two consecutive sessions. They start a two-year session next year. And then so they can, the following session they can pass, and then it would still go to the legislature at the same date. But I think one of the disadvantage they did have was there was already the right to hunt fish was already in the state constitution. Mm-hmm. So that was a block of support that you had that they did not. But mm-hmm. Hopefully the sponsor will considering bringing it back. I haven't heard what's happened yet. You know, he's also has another interesting bill. I don't know if you heard about this Texas bill that passed last session, but there was this Texas legislation allows a hunter to take wild game that's not indigenous to the state, process the wild game himself, whether it's at the site of the kill or at the the hunter's premise. They can also use a custom facility if they want, but they have the right to process the animal himself, and they can donate the meat from that animal to a food bank. So if you're talking about something that's addressing the food security issue, mm-hmm. This would be it. So they actually had a hearing on that yesterday. I haven't checked to see if it was out of committee. I think it was going to be pretty contentious because a lot of your success mm-hmm. on these depends on where you're assigned committee. And it was before the Health and Welfare Committee. So that's usually not a good sign, but it's definitely something that, I don't know about you, but the people who process their own animals, whether they're domestically raised or wild game, I hear next to nothing about any illnesses caused. So even though probably the members of a committee like Health and Welfare wouldn't want to admit it, they do have a good food safety track record. Mm-hmm. But in some ways your amendment plus legislation like this go hand in hand because they're both an attempt to address the food insecurity mm-hmm. That's going on right now. But hopefully the sponsor would be willing to bring it back next year, and maybe you can testify because I think. Yeah, this bill was before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Right to Food Amendment was before Senate Judiciary Committee. So, I think a lot of those members weren't used to hearing this type of issue. And like I mentioned to you, when they added the amendment, I thought they had a chance. You know, there was an amendment where you can't grow lands that could be used for controlled substances. There's no constitutional right to that. So they made that amendment, but it's very difficult to pass these things first year. And just, I hope the sponsors encouraged enough to continue on. Have you been contacted directly by any other states outside of West Virginia and Washington where there's been some real concerted effort to get things going?
Yeah, we talked with a woman from Illinois and then Wisconsin is another one. And then also interest, like I say, from Montana and Indiana so far. And I think that a couple members of our group have also talked with some individuals from other states too, but those haven't come directly to me. So I know a little bit less about those. But it is pretty exciting, I think, when you see what's happening in the world as well, that it's not just a conversation that's happening in Maine or in this country, but those corporate global industrial food chemical entities are putting the same kind of pressure on people at the micro level everywhere, and taking a rights-based approach to hunger and to food rights is not just happening here, but as I mentioned, Nigeria is working on it right now. Nepal has a right to food in their constitution. Ecuador, Brazil, Ireland is doing a lot of exciting things too, around the right to food and food sovereignty. So I think that, you know, it just in terms of a macro scale, people organizing and people rising up everywhere, that you know, it's just a discussion that's happening everywhere. And when we're talking about any kind of policy coherence and effectiveness that is actually addressing the needs of people, that a rights approach is just absolutely the way to go. You've got to get that foundation in place before you can build on it.
Right. So is there a meeting place for these international groups in all these different countries who are working on these measures to get together and just compare what's going on in their country? Or have there been any meetings, virtual or otherwise, with all these groups working on this issue?
That's a really awesome question. It's I would just say right now we're at a very nascent level of, you know, we've gotten some wonderful support from University of Miami Human Rights Law Clinic. And they have worked in the past. The law professor there that we've worked with most closely has worked with FIAN International, which I believe is the only international group that is specifically focused on food, human rights and food. So that's one group. And then Why Hunger has been helpful to us as well. So that's still at a national level, but they also have, are more connected to a global network of peasants and feeders or eaters everywhere around the world. So it's just beginning to percolate up from what we've been doing. There's been some talk about talking with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the right to food. But like I say, those are all just really preliminary conversations right now.
Right. Okay. Well, going back to the U.S., what's your general advice for anyone looking to adopt right to food amendment in their state? How would you start them off?
It sounds really basic, but you've got to build people power first. So often the reason that, you know, the corporations and bureaucracies can be effective is just because we all see what's happening and we become frustrated and rant, but we don't organize. And so you really have to build that people power first, educate your own community, build outward from there. Look at your own state's Declaration of Rights. In Maine, it's called that. Maybe it's called the Bill of Rights in your state constitution. And know what's in there already. Like you said, some states already have. I think there are 23 or 24 states that already have some protection for hunting and fishing rights. Maybe that's a place to build from in your state, to build outwards towards a framework of human rights for the right to food in general. Know what the food system landscape is in your state. How much food do you produce for your own citizens or your own residents in your state? Know what your food insecurity rates are. Know where there are strengths and weaknesses that can be built upward and outward and strengthened from the bottom up. And I think that's really the most important thing, is to not allow apathy and cynicism to prevent you from doing the small steps that are closest to you to do. And when you do take those steps, you're building hope. Hope ripples outward, and then it starts rippling upward as well. And then you've got an effective model to have a more just and secure food system.
Right. Yeah. You just... with everything that's gone on the last 2 years, the latest being the Ukraine-Russia war, and just the transportation costs have skyrocketed even in the last couple of weeks. You just see the importance of shorter supply chains and local and state resiliency and self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the industrial system has always been subsidized, but even with the subsidies, their costs are just increasing to the point where there's less and less difference between the cost of locally produced foods and industrial foods. So it just seems like, with each passing day, there's a greater opportunity out there.
Yeah, I think the opportunity and also the need and the desires are growing, right? The need's just becoming more visible. I think the pandemic has really unveiled a lot of the vulnerabilities of our whole system of commerce, and for people to think of themselves less as consumers and more of active, engaged citizens it will just strengthen resilience everywhere that those ideas can promulgate.
Right. Okay, so for people interested in finding out more about your success in Maine, just who did they contact? You have two groups I'm familiar with, Maine Right to Food and Food for Maine's Future. How can people get in touch with the Mainers who worked on the resolution?
Yeah, well, again, I just want to emphasize, we're a small group. You know, that whole Margaret Mead quote is really true, that a small group of committed citizens can really make change. So don't be discouraged if it takes us an eon in today's time, but maybe a week to get back to people. We're small, but we are committed, and we are so happy to help fertilize and water those seeds everywhere that they grow. So Food for Maine's Future has been the supportive organization of all of our efforts. And right now, the best place to find Food for Maine's Future is on Facebook, with just a Facebook page called Food for Maine's Future. There's another group on Facebook called Food Sovereignty and Other Grassroots Movements. That's a great place to connect with us in a, you know, more kind of intimate conversation. And then in terms of the Right to Food for Maine campaign group, we have a website called righttofoodformaine.org, and also a Facebook page called Right to Food for Maine, and on Instagram, Right to Food for Maine.
The second group, the food sovereignty group, I haven't heard that much about that. Could you, what exactly is this group again?
Oh, yeah, it was started by a supporter who ended up taking the local food and community self-governance ordinance to his town in Liberty. His name is Richard King. And so he started the Facebook group, Food Sovereignty. It was just called Food Sovereignty for Maine. And then he added the other grassroots movements. But it's just been a sort of a gathering place when we are doing active efforts of people who are wanting to engage, support, and now increasingly educate. You know, there's some great offshoots about seed saving and food growing, and you know, as you're mentioning, high fuel prices, there is more talk of a permanent agriculture, permaculture, where we're talking about perennial food sources, more fruits and nut trees. So those are all, it's sort of a meeting place for all of those ideas.
Okay. And yeah, you're saying when we talked the other day that this is a meeting season for the Maine towns looking to pass these food sovereignty ordinances. How do you see that going this winter? Just what kind of increase do you see?
Do you know, I think we're just going to keep seeing the increase is what's going to happen. Certainly these last two pandemic town meeting seasons, some towns I think didn't even have a town meeting in 2020. Or not until the fall of that year when things had stabilized some. But even without the ability to meet in person or to have as much contact with the, you know, our core group where it all began, We're just seeing that it keeps spreading exponentially. You know, the Food Sovereignty Act passed in 2017. And at that time, there were 20 towns that had adopted the ordinance. And now, four town meeting seasons later, there are 125. And so I would expect that that is just going to continue. It's a lot more accessible to people now. And then there are people on the ground in towns that have passed the ordinance. It's in every one of our 16 counties. And you just really, if you look at the map on either of those pages we mentioned, you just see the patchwork quilt that each town that passes it, there are neighboring towns that then pass it and the neighboring towns that pass it further. So we're seeing that movement that I've always considered like water, that this is just spreads like water. Sometimes it's down to a trickle, sometimes it goes underground, but then it comes back up. And we're just seeing that is really becoming a steady stream of that food sovereignty zone increasing in Maine.
Okay, yeah, just for the listeners, the Maine Food Sovereignty Act allows these towns to pass ordinances, and when they do, just unregulated producer to consumer commerce is legal in that town. Legal, unregulated producer to consumer food commerce is legal in that town. So, Heather, it's been great. Just congratulations and continued success.
Thank you so much, Pete. It is just always a great pleasure to speak with you.
All right. Take care.
You too.